Pie in the Sky Media. This series contains adult language and descriptions of graphic violence throughout. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed by guests of Criminal Mischief are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the show. Welcome back to Criminal Mischief with Carolyn and Brandon. You're listening to episode 76, The Yorkshire Ripper.
He probably committed 40 other murders or attempted murders on top of the ones he was convicted of.
How many was he convicted of?
13 murders and 7 attempted murders.
It's not exactly clear how the stranger approached 28-year-old Wilma McCann. It was the early morning hours of October 30th, 1975. What we do know is that Wilma was a young mother to 4 small children, who she was raising on her own. And on that Thursday night, she'd been out at the pub, and she was walking home. It was chilly when a stranger pulled up. He had a soft voice, a local to West Yorkshire, and most likely said something comforting, like, "Hey, love, fancy a lift?" Wilma probably wanted to get back to her children, so she climbed in. She lived nearby. Did she say something to the effect of, "Oh, it's just right there," gesturing out the window, pointing to her home that she shared with her children? Her head was turned, so she didn't see the stranger as he silently produced a hammer. She wouldn't see it coming, but felt a searing pain to the back of her head. Having just enough time to register that blow when the second one rained down, Wilma's body would be found in the early morning hours on a playing field near her home. She'd been stabbed 15 times in the neck, chest, and stomach. And the way in which she was murdered would become all too familiar over the next 6 years.
On occasions, he would talk and accompany the victim and lull her into a false sense of security, like, "This is a nice guy," and chatting with him. And then he'd sort of hesitate back till she had her back to him, then produce a hammer and smash it on the back of her head. On occasions, he used a garrote over the throat with a tourniquet and garroted them. But having subdued the victim to the point they were dying, he would then produce either a knife or a screwdriver, and he would replicate his penis by thrusting the weapon in and out of various parts of the body while he was masturbating with his other hand till he gained satisfaction. And if that would be the whole crime element, that would be the full culmination. But on a lot of occasions, he didn't achieve that because of being disturbed, so they were never then considered as part of the series.
Wilma's 4 children, ages 7, 5, 4, and 3, would awake early that morning looking for their mom. The 2 oldest wore coats and their pajamas underneath as they set out at around 5:30 that morning in the cold darkness, looking for her. They had made the decision to walk to the nearby bus stop, having no idea, in that darkness, that they would walk past her body. They sat there and waited at the bus stop. Their reasoning was that she'd be coming home on the bus, and so they waited for her at her usual stop. But they would never see their mother again. That morning, police would take all 4 children to a home. They were given hot chocolate. And then they were told that their mother had been taken to heaven and that they wouldn't be seeing her anymore. West Yorkshire is a county with a physical area of 780 square miles. Inside its borders are 5 metropolitan boroughs. The West Yorkshire police were tasked with investigating Wilma's murder. They theorized that she'd been out drinking that night and had gotten a ride home with her killer. A mother of 4 murdered under such horrific circumstances spread like wildfire and terrified the community. However, the police were quick to describe her as a good time girl, a reference to a woman of quote unquote loose morals, as if her actions had made her responsible for her own murder.
And there was huge misogyny then as well. I mean, particularly in Yorkshire was a very arrogant county as far as women were concerned. Their place was at home, preparing the meal and bringing the children up. And the men came home from work, sat at the table, expected the meal in front of them. Yes, huge misogyny. It was a man's world, basically.
Wilma McCann is the first confirmed victim of a killer the press would dub the Yorkshire Ripper. A faceless specter who terrorized Britain for the next 6 years in what would become one of the largest and most expensive manhunts in British history. Retired police intelligence officer Chris Clark.
I'm a retired police officer who spent basically from George Dixon era in the late 1960s when I joined until the mid 1990s when I left. I had diverse jobs, but intelligence based all the way through was my forte. And I've written several UK true crime serial killer books, one of which is Peter Sutcliffe.
Chris served in a county about 150 miles away from West Yorkshire. When he retired, he began researching the investigation and would go on to co-write the book Inside the Mind of the Yorkshire Ripper to bring attention to the fact that justice in this case has not been served, that it's believed that there are many, many more victims that have never been officially linked and are still unsolved to this day.
Quickly, when I researched, I realized he was parochially named as the Yorkshire Ripper, and quite clear, we're operating outside of those boundaries.
We'll get into the unsolved cases in a bit, but for now, let's start when police back then believed that the Yorkshire Ripper's murder spree began with Wilma McCann in October of 1975. At the time, her murder seemed to be swept under the rug because investigators seemingly focused on her lifestyle as a contributing factor to her murder. However, a few months later, in January of 1976, near the same area as where Wilma was murdered, 42-year-old Emily Jackson's body was found at Manor Street in Leeds. She too was a mother who went into sex work to feed her family. She too had been hit in the head with a hammer, stabbed 52 times, her clothing had been removed, and her body had been posed. Because of the way in which Wilma and Emily had been murdered, the pathologist would link their deaths to the same killer. In February of 1977, 28-year-old Irene Richardson's body would be found at a park in Leeds, which is a city in West Yorkshire. Then, 32-year-old Patricia Atkinson's body was found in Bradford 2 months later. West Yorkshire police announced they were looking for a psychopathic killer who was preying on sex workers.
Even went down to the sex workers that they were bringing it upon themselves. You know, never mind, you know, they were desperate and that's why they were on the streets to scrape a living for bringing the kids up that they had. But they were being victimized for who they were, and which was totally wrong.
Scotland Yard offers to help the West Yorkshire Police on what by then had been dubbed the Yorkshire Ripper investigation.
Scotland Yard, who were the lead force for the country, used to go out to provincial murders and assist the local police in the different counties around the country. But in Yorkshire, the chief constable was so arrogant, he didn't want Scotland Yard helping. He said, "We can solve this ourselves. You basically keep out."
The West Yorkshire Police Force was made up primarily of men in an atmosphere of institutionalized misogyny. From the very beginning of the investigation, it was as if the victims were viewed as not as worthy as others. And instead of accepting Scotland Yard's investigative support, they would put together their own profile of the killer based on their own biases, that he was murdering sex workers because he hated them, and any evidence in attacks and murders outside of West Yorkshire would not be considered because they didn't fit this rigid profile that they had created, which started off with he only murdered in West Yorkshire and that his four victims were all sex workers. But in June of 1977, 16-year-old Jane McDonald had been out with friends in Leeds. It was late when she was walking home through a playground. The next morning, her body would be found by school children. She'd been struck in the back of the head with a blunt force object. She'd been stabbed, her clothing had been removed, and she was posed. Right away, police would say publicly that the murder of Jane McDonald had been a mistake, that the Ripper had mistaken her for a sex worker because she was out late, because Jane came from a quote-unquote good family. They would say she was an innocent, as if the women that had been murdered before hadn't been.
There was a quotation in the Yorkshire Ripper series when a 16-year-old girl was attacked that he's claimed an innocent victim. Well, they were all innocent victims. It was just that the ladies who did the sex trade, it was so easy to get them into a car. But these ladies, I mean, some of them 14-year-old. I mean, you know, and if a girl from a nice background was 14-year-old, they got care and protection. If they came from the back streets at 14 and selling the body, then they were written off. I mean, horrendous.
This time period is before computers, so the investigation was run on a system of index cards, which were basically collected in these long wooden boxes and stacked on top of each other. Police scientists actually went to the head of the investigation to offer to computerize the entire investigation, which he turned down, saying it was too expensive. In October of 1977, 20-year-old Jean Jordan's body was found in a green space. She'd been hit in the head with a hammer, stabbed, her clothing had been removed, and her body was posed. She was a young mother of two from Scotland, living in Manchester, who worked as a sex worker to get by. And during the post-mortem, it was determined that the killer had returned to mutilate her remains again. Investigators would get a clue. They found her purse, and inside, there was a brand new 5-pound note. We know now that the killer had gone back because he realized that investigators could potentially trace that 5-pound note back to him. After he'd murdered Jean, he'd thrown her purse into the bushes. But when he went back, for a second time, he couldn't find the purse. Investigators were able to trace that bill by its serial number to a bank in Bradford. And from there, they discovered that the bill had gone to a factory that had paid out its employees in cash. It was a truck hauling firm where the killer was a driver. 12 officers would go to the factory and interview all the employees, including the killer, who they would ultimately discount as a suspect because he claimed he was at a housewarming party at the time of Jean's murder, and he didn't seem to fit their profile of who they believed the killer was. To say that the West Yorkshire police had blinders on would be generous, because they would dismiss any crime against women in other jurisdictions, even if it fit the killer's signature, saying, nope, our guy doesn't kill outside of West Yorkshire. Nope, our guy only kills sex workers. If the crime didn't fit the MO perfectly, say the victim was hit with a rock instead of a hammer, nope, our guy only uses a hammer. Because women would come forward, saying that they believed that they had survived an attack by the Ripper. But they were gaslit into changing their stories because investigators purposely wanted to keep the victim count connected to the so-called Yorkshire Ripper down.
But West Yorkshire police themselves, there were many, many cases they pushed to one side because they were overwhelmed and they didn't want to add any more to the tally. It's despicable the lengths they went to cover up. There was one woman who I know of. She was attacked, smashed on the back of the head and stabbed and left in the doorway. She was found a bit later. And when she was in hospital, the senior investigating officer went to her and told her it was a domestic between her and her husband because she'd gone out nightclubbing, leaving 4 children at home. And those are the lengths of cover-up that they went to prevent the tally being any bigger than they had.
They basically gaslit her and manipulated her into agreeing to that when she was in the hospital?
Yes, many, many survivors. And there are 13 that Lord Byford, who eventually did the report as to the failures, identified 13 additional women who are alive today who West Yorkshire Police denied ever being a victim.
Throughout the investigation, 3 men would be falsely accused in murder cases that are believed to be attributed to the Yorkshire Ripper. These men were sentenced to prison for decades until their convictions were ultimately quashed. In January of 1978, 18-year-old Helen Ritka and 21-year-old Yvonne Pearson would be found murdered. Their murders were believed to be attributed to the Yorkshire Ripper. In May of 1978, Vera Millward's body was found on the grounds of Manchester's Royal Infirmary. In 1978, police would receive 2 letters from a man who claimed he was the Yorkshire Ripper. He would sign these letters as Jack the Ripper. Then, in June of 1979, the same man sending the letters would also record a message to the West Yorkshire Police, who were convinced that this man, who called himself Jack, was the Yorkshire Ripper. Here's the audio from that tape that was played during a press conference.
I'm Jack. I see you are still having no look catching me. I have the greatest respect for you, George. But Lord, you are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started. I reckon your boys are letting you down, George. They can't be much good, can they? The only time they came near catching me was a few months back in Chapel Town when I was disturbed. I warned you in March that I'd strike again. Sorry it wasn't Bradford. I'm not quite sure when I'll strike again, but it will be definitely sometime this year. I'm not sure where. Maybe Manchester. I like it there. There's plenty of them knocking about. They never learn, do they, George? I bet you've warned them, but they never listen. Well, it's been nice chatting to you, George. Yours, Chuck the Ripper.
The media would dub the man on the recording as the Wearside Jack. That tape was played to the women who had survived the killer, and they would all say that it wasn't him, that the man who attacked them had a soft, local Yorkshire accent, whereas the Wearside Jack, or the man who said he was the Yorkshire Ripper, had a Geordie accent, basically an accent from neighboring regions in the northeast of England. But the officers dismissed the survivors, which meant the killer was free to go about murdering and attacking women, while the police launched a massive manhunt for the man on the tape. A huge amount of resources would be allocated to what they would find out later was a total hoax. Billboards were erected, the police would distribute letters to the press, alerting people to call a special number so that they could hear the tape recording of the man that they believed was the Yorkshire Ripper. In 1979, the bodies of Josephine Whittaker and Barbara Leach would be found and attributed to the Yorkshire Ripper. In August of 1980, 47-year-old Marguerite Walls's body was found in Leeds. And in November of 1980, 20-year-old Jacqueline Hill's body was found on vacant land in Leeds, bringing the number of Yorkshire Ripper murders up to 13.
But there are so many witnesses that had already told them that he was a Yorkshireman. He had a moustache and beard. He talked with an insipid high voice, and he had a local accent to Bradford. And they also identified his cars, different elements. One of them was a 14-year-old schoolgirl he attacked in 1975 with a hammer and left her for dead, throwing her over a hedge. They denied ever that she was a victim of his because it wasn't in a red light district. And my thoughts are, well, how many men were in Yorkshire going around bashing women on the back of the head with a hammer? And it was one. So there were three of those examples before Wilma McCann, who was the first sex worker who was murdered. There were three women who were attacked with a hammer in the preceding 3 months. They didn't join the dots.
Did anything, well, it sounds like they didn't want to join the dots. It really sounds like they wanted to keep everybody like, hey, it's over just in the red district. Everybody else is safe. It's just, you know, these quote unquote bad women, you know, who deserve it and nothing to see over here. I mean, is that basically, they could have connected the dots. They didn't want to.
No, I think they're just useless. I mean, later on, yes, there was corruption. They didn't want to, but to start with, they failed to join the dots up. Two women got attacked within 4 miles of each other, a month apart in July and August 1975, which they failed to join into the series when it started in October. Their starting point was October when Wilma McCann was murdered forward. Yet these other three victims had all had suffered the same. It was just they was disturbed, so he didn't carry out. Otherwise, they would have been the first murder victims.
And by denying that the so-called Yorkshire Ripper was killing in other jurisdictions was irresponsible.
Describe that time period, because you were there, you weren't working the case, but you remember the fear and the, you know, terror about what this type of, because he got away with it for quite some time, right?
Yes. I mean, he basically got away with it for 16 years. But as far as people in Yorkshire and Manchester, he operated for those 5 years. And so women in the north of England were very, very fearful going out in pairs sometimes, taking evasive action so they didn't become a victim. But the rest of the country were unaware he was operating. He had a sister-in-law in London, and he had a sister in the Midlands in Derbyshire. So he was traveling. He was a traveling criminal before the era knew of traveling criminals in our country. So there was these borders that police operated within, the same as your counties in the States, that you're not allowed to go outside of that invisible boundary, yet the criminal crossed over those boundaries.
Women would take to the streets in Leeds in 1980 during a Reclaim the Night protest. They wanted to spread the message far and wide that these were crimes against women by a man that the police had failed to catch because they believed their attitudes about who the victims were and their biases tainted the investigation.
Men off the streets! Men off the streets!
But women started to have protests, basically, because, you know, police's response to them was like, you need to stay at home, you need to not go out. If you do go out, you need to go out with people. And they were like, why should we have to stay home? Why, we shouldn't have to be the ones to stay home so men can not be tempted or whatever. Like, you guys need to go out and catch this person and not expect us to have to stay at home. That's so true. It crosses all states and countries. Like, why do the women have to be the one to adjust what we do to keep men in line or whatever, right?
Yeah. The women went out and campaigned saying men off the streets because they're saying, why should we have a curfew? We're the victims. And exactly that's why they campaigned. I mean, equal opportunities came into this country in 1976, right in the middle of the Yorkshire Ripper fiasco. So women were becoming liberated and start realizing they had a voice, yet they were still being suppressed.
A report from BBC Newsnight.
In Leeds, Jim Hobson's new team of policemen has now taken over the Ripper inquiry. And already they claim to have had a pile of new information from the public. But they warn women who've been going out armed with knives and sharpened steel combs that they do risk arrest for carrying offensive weapons. Tonight, one hospital in Leeds is on red alert after telephone threats that one of the nurses there would be the Ripper's 14th victim. The deep sense of fear and resentment that has built up in this Yorkshire community after 5 years of fruitless police inquiries into these brutal murders is hard to convey. But Martin Young has gone straight to the emotional heart of it.
I came to Leeds last week to report on the sad sequence to a dreadful killing, to follow the 13th murder hunt that struggled to find the Yorkshire Ripper. The scene here at Milgarth, the main police station in Leeds, was all too familiar. The Ripper incident room, awash with statements of witnesses and reports. Policemen working all around the clock. But somehow, here in the streets of West Yorkshire, there's a feeling that all the police can do is sift through the same evidence yet again. No, there's a much stronger feeling about. It's almost tangible. It's a feeling of deep revulsion, a wall of hate directed at the psychopath who's called himself Jack the Ripper. There have been 17 attacks now, 13 of them murders. The relatives and friends of those people attacked and murdered now number literally hundreds of people. But here in Leeds, there is no one who's not touched by the hatred the Ripper has spawned.
Here's a compilation of families of the victims and survivors who wanted to speak directly to the serial killer at large in 1980.
Mrs. Irene MacDonald, her daughter was murdered in 1977.
I just see you as a beast with no feelings, and you're a coward. Why do you come up and stalk young girls, innocent girls as well? You come up from behind them, they don't have a chance. You're not a man, you're a beast, and I hate you. And I believe all the population in Leeds and everywhere hate you.
Mrs. Patricia Brandsburg, her niece was murdered in 1977.
Jane was a beautiful girl. You took life from her. You destroyed her family in one way or another. Her father just deteriorated. You're not a man. You're despicable. I despise you intensely.
Mrs. Olive Smelt. She was attacked in 1975.
Oh, you can hit the headlines all right, but It's nothing to be proud of, the things that you'll do. And I just don't know how you can sleep at night.
Mr. Harry Smelt. His wife was attacked in 1975.
Of all the women you've killed, I think, if you were to take a census of them all, I think, given the opportunity to do as you wish with them, I think they would rate you pretty low sexually. I think that's what it's all about. You're proving you're a man by killing them. Most men don't have to kill women to prove that they're a man.
Mr. Hayden Hiley, his daughter was murdered in 1979.
You are the lowest of the low. You did mention, I believe it was in your tape to the police, that you wanted to be mentioned in the Guinness Book of Records. I'll go along with that. You should be classed as the biggest coward the world has ever known. Put that in the Guinness Book of Records.
Mrs. Avril Hiley. Her daughter was murdered in 1979.
I think you're probably a very inadequate person, certainly physically, and probably mentally too. You're not significant at all. I don't think you can make a relationship with a woman, certainly not a live one. Possibly the only relationship you can make is with a dead one, as you've proved.
Maureen Long. She was attacked and stabbed in 1977.
Someone wants to get hold of you and do the same things to you as well, which it might do, if they come face to face with you. You'd be better off killing yourself before someone else does it.
Mrs. Beryl Leach. Her daughter was murdered in 1979.
If I were you, I'd look over your shoulder. Somebody's looking for you. Many people are looking for you, and they all hate you.
Mr. David Leach. His daughter was murdered in 1979.
Frank, I just think you're an obscenity on the face of the earth, and the sooner that you're caught and put away, it can't be soon enough for me. They should lock you away and throw away the key and forget about you for the rest of your life.
On Friday, January 2nd, 1981, police in Sheffield would observe a car parked with a man and woman inside. They'd clocked the suspicious vehicle earlier in the night in the red light district.
The areas that he was operating in became hot spots, and he realized they were too hot. So he moved from West Yorkshire down into South Yorkshire to a city called Sheffield, and he propositioned a sex worker in Sheffield. They were parked up, and he had his tools of trade with him ready to kill her. When a local sergeant and constable uniform, they knew the area was a red light district, and they saw the car parked up, and they recognized the lady he was with as being a known sex worker.
Officers would run the license plate on the vehicle, which was a Rover, and they found out that it had a false plate, which belonged to a different make and model of a car. So they went up to the vehicle and asked the man his name, which also didn't match the registration. That's when they asked him to exit the vehicle. They were going to arrest him for stealing a car. But as he got out, they didn't see him slip a hammer and knives into his pocket.
He had secreted in his car jacket a hammer and two knives. They put the lady into the panda car. He said he needed to relieve himself. They didn't search him. They allowed him to go out of sight, allegedly to urinate. And while he was out of sight, they heard a clatter. And what happened, he managed to put his hammer and one of the knives down in some bushes. And they said, "Oi, come back." And he came back and he still had one knife secreted on him. They put him in the car without searching him with the lady. Then they took him to the local police station. And then he said, "I want a wee." And they said, "Well, haven't you already had one?" "Yeah, but not enough." They let him go unaccompanied into a police station toilet. He lifted the cistern up and put the other knife inside the cistern and came back out.
They brought the man into an interview room where he gave his real name, Peter Sutcliffe. Sutcliffe was married. He worked as a truck driver. On the outside, he appeared totally normal. But when they looked at his record, they saw he'd been interviewed 9 times in the Yorkshire Ripper case. And he looked like the sketch that multiple women who had survived the attacks had given.
They eventually got some suspicion he might have something to do with the Yorkshire Ripper. So they phoned the headquarters and they originally said, "No, he's been alibied that many times. Now he's clearly just a punter." And someone else overruled that and said, "Bring him through here to our headquarters," which they did. He realized, because they also wanted to take a blood test from him, and the Yorkshire Ripper was blood type B negative, non-secretor, which is a very, very rare blood. You can have a blood group B secretor, but he was a non-secretor, which means very few or none of his antigens go from his blood into his semen, saliva, sweat, etc.
That night, Peter Sutcliffe would be arrested on suspicion of being the Yorkshire Ripper.
He is being questioned in relation to the Yorkshire Ripper murders. It is anticipated that he will appear before the court in Dewsbury tomorrow.
Is it fair then to say that the general hunt for the so-called Yorkshire Ripper is now being wound down from this moment on?
Right.
Can you tell us whether he has a Geordie accent?
I cannot tell you that because I've not heard him speak. But I can tell you that we are absolutely delighted with developments at this stage. Absolutely delighted.
Can you all smile?
Really delighted.
You're
all delighted as well. Yes. Absolutely delighted.
So let's break down that presser real quick. First, the reporter cheekily asks about the Geordie accent. Remember, the West Yorkshire police were convinced, based on the Weirjack tape, that the killer had a Geordie accent. Even when the victims who had actually escaped him and heard the tape said, it's not him. Secondly, it really rubbed people the wrong way as they watched these higher-ups giggling, basically, at this press conference, and all the while made no mention of the victims and their families. It just felt extremely disrespectful and inappropriate. But it wasn't long before Peter Sutcliffe would confess to being the Yorkshire Ripper.
Overnight, they eventually realized they had got the Yorkshire Ripper before he'd admitted it. When those policemen came back on duty the night shift who'd arrested him, they saw that this man had been arrested on suspicion of being the Yorkshire Ripper. They then went back on their journey to where they'd nicked him the night before and found the hammer and one of the knives. And that's what clinched it. They then went back to their police station and found the other knife in the toilet. They phoned the headquarters and said, we've got a hammer and two knives that this bloke's dropped. At that point, Sutcliffe realised the game was up and coughed. But he only coughed to the ones they put to him.
When the public got a glimpse of the 34-year-old, who was the so-called Yorkshire Ripper, he looked like a diabolical version of Wolfman Jack from the 1973 movie American Graffiti. He had coiffed hair and a wiry trimmed beard with these evil beady looking eyes. And they found out that Sutcliffe wasn't a Geordie, but had actually grown up in West Yorkshire.
Basically, he was quite an insipid child, a weakling, and at the age of two, he couldn't actually stand up. So his father bought him some reinforced boots, which helped to stabilize his legs. So he could actually walk. So instead of using leg irons, he had these special boots made for him as a toddler to get around. And he was always hanging on to his mother's apron string, literally. A weak child, and his father was a typical Yorkshireman, robust, and wanted Peter to be a man. So there was this conflict from the early stages of mum doting on him and dad trying to toughen him up. When he went to school, he was bullied, he was shy, and on occasions he would hide in the loft of their house rather than go to school. And it was only when the school attendance officer said, Peter's not been at school, they realised where he was, hiding in the loft between 9 o'clock and school leaving off time, and then coming out of the loft to join the family.
They began digging into Sutcliffe's life, how he was bullied at school and eventually dropped out when he was 15.
When Sutcliffe became a teenager, he decided to toughen up. He got himself a bull worker, and he gained immense upper strength, biceps, torso. Although his legs were still how they were as a kid, his upper half was, he gained immense strength from working out.
At 18, Sutcliffe would get a job as a gravedigger. He would use scissors to cut off the fingers of the dead to remove their rings. He would use pliers to remove gold teeth, and he would sell these items. He also washed the bodies of the dead, and it's believed that here is where he first engaged in necrophilia.
Got this job in the cemetery, which as he was developing sexually, he was getting off on handling dead people because they were compliant. Dead women were compliant to him. Whereas growing up as a teenager, he couldn't make relationships with girls at school. He was shy and introvert, and he was also impotent. So he really learned that sexual satisfaction gained from a compliant dead body. And that's what he was doing until when he got the sack for poor timekeeping.
It's around 1969 where Chris actually believes that Sutcliffe truly began his killing spree, not in 1975.
Back in 1969, 6 years before the Ripper series, Sutcliffe was arrested in the red light district in Bradford, his hometown, crouching behind the hedge with a hammer. The policeman who found him thought he was going to burgle the house and wrongly arrested him for going equipped to burgle instead of being equipped with an offensive weapon. The car had been seen half an hour earlier in the red light district, unattended, and the same car he found unattended with Sutcliffe hiding behind the hedge. They couldn't put two and two together.
Did he have a personality that helped disarm people, including law enforcement, including people who knew him? You know, I know it sounds like he was teased and stuff when he was younger, but, you know, sometimes that plays a part in, you know, people get, you know, a person getting away with stuff longer than they should.
He was a family man. He was a social animal. He had a job, a lorry driver, a good income. He lived in a good part of Bingley in a three-bedroom house, a detached house. He just looked like Mr. Average, basically. There was nothing outstanding if you looked at him to say, to weed him any different from any other normal guy.
3 months after his arrest, Sutcliffe would go on trial. Basically, he was charged with the 13 counts of murder and 7 counts of attempted murder that the West Yorkshire police had attributed to him over the last 6 years. But he wouldn't confess to any of the other murders and attacks on women in jurisdictions outside of West Yorkshire. Sutcliffe would plead insanity, claiming he was on a divine mission to rid the world of sex workers, that he was guided by voices in his head telling him to do it. But it's widely believed that he was not insane, but was a psychopathic serial killer.
Peter Sutcliffe, his pedigree was that as a juvenile, he worked in a cemetery in Yorkshire. And as puberty turned into manhood, he gained satisfaction, necrophilic satisfaction, from handling dead bodies. When he got sacked from the cemetery, he no longer had that viability. So he then had to find someone to kill to regain that satisfaction. And that's what drove Peter Sutcliffe. It was not hatred of women, not hatred of prostitutes. He was impotent, and basically the only way he got it up was in the act of killing. He had to have someone who was dying, so he smashed them on the back of the head with a hammer or garrotted them, and he then mutilated them, replicating the knife or the screwdriver as his penis. And he then masturbated over the victim. And that's how he gained his satisfaction. And that's what drove him to become the multi-serial killer that he's known for.
Sutcliffe would be found guilty on all charges and was jailed for life. But what about all the other cases? Over the years, why wouldn't they prosecute him for the cases that matched his MO, where he was in the area at the time of the murders and attacks? The official explanation would come down to one quote: not in the public interest.
After his arrest and conviction in 1981, there were clearly other police forces who had similar cases they thought might have something to do with him. So instead of inviting them up for them to interview him, West Yorkshire Police decided to work through a mediator. So they asked Keith Helliwell to gather all the crime files of other police forces and go through them, review them, and see if there were parameters that would go take to have Sutcliffe interviewed. And what happened? Keith Helliwell spent 10 years investigating 78 murders, 78 other unsolved murders around the country, and whittled them down to a reasonable number, and went to Sutcliffe, who by this time was in Broadmoor Mental Hospital. You have to build a rapport to get something from them. So he built a rapport with Sutcliffe, and so he coughed to two of them. And one of them was the 14-year-old schoolgirl I mentioned earlier, and a 17-year-old student out of the whole tally, hoping that Keith would go away satisfied. But he was never convicted, never charged or convicted with them, because our Home Secretary of the day, no, the Director of Public Prosecution, said it wasn't in the public interest to charge Sutcliffe with any more cases.
On November 13th, 2020, Peter Sutcliffe would die in prison from COVID at the age of 74, which means a lot of his crimes would die with him. It's hard to believe that in Britain, according to Chris, there is still no central database like we have in the States, which link unsolved cold cases from the 60s and 70s. And back then, they didn't keep evidence from crime scenes, so there's no hope at DNA testing to link these crimes to Peter Sutcliffe. At the end of the day, it's most likely that these cases, believed to be committed by Peter Sutcliffe, will never be solved by law enforcement, because it's not in the interest of the government to do so.
The problem is the public have been kept in the dark. Lord Byford's report as to what went wrong, which was a public inquiry paid for by the British taxpayers, never saw the light of day until 2006. It was put in the library of the House of Commons after part of it was read out to the Houses of Parliament. It was placed in the library so only members of Parliament could see it if they wanted to. So the wider public never knew of what actually went wrong, just apart from snippets. And it took till 2006. And since then, there has been a furore with the British public as to it went wrong, but it's too little, too late.
And the government makes it very clear that it's not in their interest, as they make it almost impossible for anyone in the public sector to investigate these cases.
Have they released the audio of the interviews that he did with the chief constable?
No, they're not in the public domain. Everything's sealed till 2045, I believe.
Really?
Yes. This is how they get round it. Our Freedom of Information Act is rubbish. They only release what they want to release. Anything that's a bit sensitive, unlike yourselves, they slap a year date on it. And the other thing is, if you apply for a freedom information, we're told once you apply, the clock starts ticking again. So if someone applies for Sutcliffe's files now, instead of being 2045, they'll add another 20 years on. So basically what they don't want any generation alive that would have an axe to grind if they saw the papers.
So even though the 13 cases have been adjudicated, those files are still sealed.
Oh, they're sealed, yes.
And even though it went to trial?
Yeah. Yes, everything is sealed. There is nothing that you can actually get.
After a long career in law enforcement, Chris's views on the West Yorkshire Police are scathing.
The whom and misery that these evil bastards cause. And if someone can look at it like they have with the Yorkshire Ripper, I've had some families who felt they've been given some closure because they realise, yes, even though the police have not got him for it, it was definitely Peter Sutcliffe who murdered their sister. And to them, that means everything, that someone cares enough to give them that relief.
Up next, we have our bonus episode on the Yorkshire Ripper, which is available right now. Our bonus content is a place where my co-host Brandon Morgan and I discuss the case in more detail. It's a more relaxed conversation, so we hope you'll join us. And as always, thanks for listening. From Cloud 10, Criminal Mischief is a Pie in the Sky production, recorded in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. We're produced by Brandon Morgan and myself, music by Soundstripe. I'm Carolyn Osorio, your writer and host.